House Labor and Commerce will now come to order, or we come back from a overnight recess. Today is Tuesday, the 5th of March. We have Representative Chenault, Representative Herron, Representative Reinbold, Representative Josephson, Representative Millette. We have one excused absence, and we definitely have a quorum to conduct business. Please turn off your cell phones. They will interfere with the equipment. Like, that's why mine's broken in. But we have four bills on the calendar today. The first one is House Bill 71. Come on back, Ginger. We've previously heard this bill. We're still open for public testimony. In a minute, yeah. And we first heard it on February 18th, and at that time it was brought to our attention that the auditors program had not been audited since its inception, I believe, in the early 80s, Chris, roughly. And for that reason, we did a CS, which, can I have a motion to adopt the CS?
I move C, Committee Substitute House Bill 71, version U, as the working document.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion. So before us, we have the CS, and I think everybody in the room, if they don't have a copy, they're out on the table.
They're not on the table.
They're not out on the table.
I didn't see them out there.
They're all out there.
Magic.
Must be too early.
Ginger, could you read yourself onto the record, please?
Thank you. My name is Ginger Blaisdell. I'm staff to Representative Hughes, who is on her way to Washington, D.C. right now. And the auditor reauthorization, we were requested by a couple of auditor program chairmen to extend the auditor program. It periodically doesn't really sunset, it ends. And right now in statute, it would end on June 30 of 2013. And so we've introduced House Bill 71 to extend that date until 2018. And as we reviewed the program further, we found that there had never been an audit completed on the program. And so just for performance sake, we thought that might be a good idea to conduct an audit or request an audit. And then in the CS, the date changes to 2016, and that would be the year following the potential completion date of an audit.
Chris, welcome back. Please state your name and affiliation for the record, and tell us if 2016 will give you adequate time to audit the program. And anything else you'd care to add?
For the record, my name is Chris Curtis, Legislative Auditor. We do believe that 2016 would be appropriate. We would expect to start this in January timeframe, or possibly earlier, and we would certainly have it available. 2016 would be a very safe date, very conservative date to allow us time.
Any questions? Representative Herron.
No real question, but maybe more of a comment both to you and to Chris is that I concur that an audit is needed, not only because it hasn't had one in 25 years, but that in conversations with others is that maybe the auditor program during this audit should be reviewed for possible consolidation. We do have, I believe, 12 out there, but there are some underperformers out there, and maybe a fewer number of auditors may be beneficial to the overall health of the effort. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions? Representative Millette.
I just want to echo Representative Herron's comments. As I said on the subcommittee budget for, I think it's under Community and Regional Affairs, I mean economic development maybe, we're spending $807,000 a year for 12 auditors. So it works out, the math works out to $62,000 to each one of the auditors. And so my question is we've got auditors that are very, very prolific AEDC in Anchorage. We've got Swampsea. We've got Southeast Conference that are doing a great job. But I don't know what Dillingham, you know, Cordova, Juneau, Bethel, Nome are doing with their $62,000. It's a frustration for me. And then I look at the way that we've structured Swampsea, Southeast Conference, and Anchorage Economic Development Council, and there's such a private sector engagement in those economic development groups. And at some point, I don't think that the state should be continuing to fund at the tune of $800,000 a year something that can be taken over by the private sector. When we were duplicating, we have our own Department of Economic Development. Now we're passing it on to a more local community, which I understand, but it just doesn't seem cost-effective to give $62,000 to 12 different organizations. I just don't know if we're getting our bang for the buck. And so I'm not very enamored with the ARDR program. I understand what it was developed to do and what it was developed for, but I'm not sure that it's effective. So that's my thoughts on the program. Mr. Chairman.
Well, Chris, I believe that would be a portion of your audit anyway, wouldn't it?
Through the chair, yes. We would definitely take those concerns that I've heard today in working with FINDRA and helping draft an audit request. It would be considered a special audit request approved by the committee, so it will be put in with the rest of the requests and audited first in, first out, typically. So we'll certainly look at the legislative intent of the program when it was created. I think we will review testimony at this committee to make sure the concerns are addressed when we draft the request.
Speaker Chenault, did you have a question? Nope. Any further questions for either Ginger or Chris?
Just a quick comment, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Josephson.
I sat on the subcommittee for Commerce this year, and the ARDR budget's been cut. It's going to have to fight for its survival. I mean, it has sort of that look about it. And that's just for the information of the committee.
Any further questions? I'm going to remove my objection to the CS and bring the CS back to the committee. Is there any objection to the CS? CS is adopted, and we left public testimony open last time we heard this bill. Thank you again. Is there anybody in the room that would care to testify on this bill that hasn't previously? Seeing none, is there anybody online? And with that, we will close out public testimony and bring the bill back to the committee. What are the wishes of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I've obviously voiced my opinion on this, and to keep this program going and spend, see the audit, we'll be spending a couple $1 million to continue the program that we don't know whether it's productive or not, or if these organizations even need the $62,000 to survive. You know, extending it until the LBNA does an audit on it, I think we can probably bring these people before the committee one by one and ask them what their accomplishments are, and I've tried to do that with some of them. And what I've heard from each one of the ARDRs is they echo exactly what our Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development are doing. It just seems like a large duplication in government when we talk about where we want to spend our dollars and what we want to do with cutting the budget and being fiscally responsible. I'm just not sure that this program is worth $800,000 every single year. So I'm not a big fan of this, and I'm not going to object to it moving out of the committee. I'm going to recommend that the program sunset.
Would you like to hold on to it, or
no,
I
can voice my opinion on the floor, and I can talk to other people about it, but like I said, there's some groups that have private sector money that have been incredibly successful in what they've done. They've done energy plans, and they've done, but then we've got a whole slew of people, like Representative Herron talked about, a slew of groups that just take the $62,000 and maybe fill a position. And that's not what this program was designed to do. And now we've got all this incredible duplication within government that we're funding not only commerce, but now we're funding the arters. And so I'm just concerned that when we start talking about really tightening our belt, this might be a program that is a large duplication within state government. And so not a fan, not going to hold up the bill, but I'm not going to be voting for this bill when it gets to the floor. So.
I thought we just moved the bill, but...
No, we adopted the bill.
All right.
We're going to close out public testimony now.
Gotcha.
Did we?
I would be of the view that because, as I said, the Commerce Subcommittee cut the budget, but it certainly there was no testimony or inclination of the chairwoman, Representative Costello, to see it to its demise. That I agree with Representative Millett that this is a conversation for the floor. I mean, there's been no sort of dialogue about just ending the thing.
Representative Herron.
Yeah, I think to continue this discussion, it's important is that I think the ARTER program, given the right circumstances by some, is actually very important to the state, because I don't think the department has the boots on the ground that can really generate localized efforts that really do contribute. So again, I guess that I'll defend the ARTER except for the underperformers, and clearly there are, and so consolidation and better use of state dollars is probably appropriate, Mr. Chairman.
Well, I should point out this is going on to finance too, so I think it will probably get an additional vetting before it gets to the floor. Representative Reinbold, any comments or any further comments? What are the wishes of the committee?
I move Committee Substitute House Bill 71, version U, from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Seeing no objection, the bill will move on to finance, and we'll take a brief at ease. We're back on the record. The next item on the calendar is House Bill 84, Military Training Credit Temporary License. Catchy title. We have Kim Skipper from Representative Sadler's office. I believe Representative Sadler is in the air or home or
he's leaving on a jet plane.
Leaving on a jet plane, that works. Welcome back, Kim. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kim Skipper, staff to Representative Sadler of Eagle River. We're here talking about House Bill 84, which is Military Training Credit and Temporary Licensing. The goal of HB 84 is to help separating service members transition quickly and effectively into the workforce. Each year, approximately 1,200 service members separate from the service in Alaska. Americans in the military service receive world-class training, education, and experience during their time in uniform, assets that shouldn't be lost to them or to our communities as they transition to civilian careers. House Bill 84 asks the Division of Professional Licensing, the University of Alaska, and the Department of Labor to evaluate military training and education and assign civilian credit where it's appropriate without compromising current licensing standards. This bill improves the probability of veterans finding jobs by accelerating licensing process and early education credits. Service members often experience delays and lost opportunities qualifying for licenses and academic credit, even though they have the applicable training and experience. As of July 2012, 19 states have enacted legislation, and over 30 states are considering similar legislation in 2013. This bill was brought before the last session in the 27th legislature by Representative Bill Thomas, and so it's being reintroduced this year. With force reductions, budget cuts, and now sequestration will soon mean even more veterans seeking civilian jobs. I think we have an obligation to find ways to give them every opportunity to leverage their military experience into academic credit, job certification, or vocational training credits. Bills like HB 84 help make that happen to everyone's benefit. I do have a few lifelines available. Sarah Chambers with Professional Licensing Operations Manager, Greg Cashin, the Assistant Commissioner, Labor and Workforce Development. I believe online is Jeff Selvey, Executive Director of the Alaska Workforce Investment Board. Paula Scabera with the Department of Labor is here, and Aaron Schroeder with the Veterans Caucus is also in the audience. And with that, any questions?
You want to tell us about the fiscal note?
The fiscal note's about, I think, $137,000. It's basically for the Professional Licensing Board. The effective date on the bill is 12/31/2013, so it gives those people of the licensing boards opportunity to get together to meet the requirements of the bill.
Any Representative Jimson?
Yes. Ms. Skipper, if I look at page 2, right in the middle of that page, subsection B, should the committee be concerned at all? It's an or bill, meaning you can qualify for this temporary license with either an A or a B subsection. Should the committee be concerned at all about the required experience that a military member should have along with a degree, diploma, or certificate in that B subsection?
The certification or credits require a substantially equivalent, so as the boards look through all the licensing requirements, if there's substantially equivalent experience and the academic or training credits, then the license can be issued. But it has to be substantial. I can certainly ask, I think, Sarah or I think Aaron Schroeder's in the audience as well, if they can probably expand on my information.
Okay. And as a follow-up, if I can, where it says in subsection C, the department or applicable board shall expedite procedure, what do you have... what do you envision there?
They're trying to move the veterans ahead of the line to try to give them priority for getting licensing.
Okay.
And just speed up the process, basically.
Okay. All right. I don't have any other questions. Although after Ms. Skipper, if someone from the department wanted to test.
Yeah, we've got about 3 people in the room and at least 1 or 2 online. Certainly, Representative Reinbold.
First of all, I just want to say hello, and thank you very much for bringing this bill. I think it's a good bill, and I think, you know, there's lots of noteworthy comments in here, but one is that we already have paid for training for these people through federal tax dollars, mm-hmm. So it only makes sense to go ahead and, it's like transferring credits from another university, transferring experience, and so I just want to make a comment that I think it's a really, really good idea, and I'm glad this bill got brought before us.
Right, thank you.
Thank you, Kim. Representative Aaron.
Thank you, Kim. I guess the chairman asked you to explain the fiscal note. I guess I'm missing something here, but we're not creating a new board, are we?
No, but what they're going to have to do with the board is meet the effective date. They need to have the 11 affected boards schedule meetings and go over the requirements that the bill is asking them to do. I don't know if Sarah Chambers would you be better at?
Come on up, Sarah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name
Before we get started, I'd like to recognize that we have Representative Tammy Wilson, who has been in the corner since before we started the meeting, and just thought I wasn't going to recognize her.
Quiet as...
Welcome.
Quiet as a church mouse?
Yeah. So far. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Sarah Chambers. I'm the Operations Manager for the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing.
Do you have prepared comments, or are you looking for questions?
I'm happy to answer any questions.
Representative Heron.
I support the bill. I'm going to vote for the bill wherever it's at in the process, but it's not calling for a new board, but asking these boards to, I guess I don't understand, we can't do this in the current makeup of the boards that we have to review this?
Through the chair, the concern that that we have expressed through the fiscal note is that the given the time frame, many of our boards don't meet frequently enough to be able to accomplish this task to determine equivalency and propose regulations to articulate that equivalency to staff so they can properly administer the licensure. So we are looking at an estimate of an additional meeting for each of the affected boards to be able to deliberate and work through the regulations process. There are an additional handful of programs that are also affected that the division itself administers. So we also have, as part of that fiscal note, the cost of adopting regulations and properly public noticing all our licensees.
Well, no further questions, Mr. Chairman, other than that we asked Finance to review this a little bit more. Thank you.
Yep, it's the next stop. We got us out of committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, we have one gentleman in the room who is a familiar face to most of us who has signed up to testify, Chris Christensen, University of Alaska. Did you put Y down by mistake, or did you sign up? Was that supposed to be a question, Mark?
I'll try not to take too much time, Mr. Chair.
Welcome back.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Chris Christensen with the University of Alaska. I'm here today to talk about Section 2 of the bill, which directs the university's president to adopt policies and procedures to award credit for military training, education, and service time. And while the bill has not yet become law, I'm happy to tell you that the university is in compliance with this mandate. I just want to begin by noting that the university is committed to offering a quality education experience to active military veterans and their dependents. GI Jobs Magazine, which is a magazine and web portal that exists specifically to serve military members in their transition back to civilian life, has designated both UAA and UAF as military-friendly schools. Only 15% of all the universities, colleges, and vocational schools in the country got this designation. This is probably one of the reasons that the Department of Defense is pushing this legislation nationwide. It's actually a pretty sad commentary on education in the lower 48 that so few schools actually get this designation. The web portal guidetoonlineschools.com, which bills itself as the most comprehensive authority on distance education, has last year put out a list of the most military-friendly online colleges in the country, and we're proud that the University of Alaska was rated number 5. And as the entity that made this rating possible by your support, we think you should be very proud of that also. I'm based in Anchorage, so I'm, while I work for the statewide system, I'm most familiar with UAA. That campus has close to 2,000 active military veterans and family members on it this year, which is about 10% of the student body. Now, after winning the military-friendly designation 3 years in a row, UAA didn't just rest on its laurels. Last year, it formed a military and veteran student task force, which is currently inventorying all the existing services that we provide, programs, academic and administrative policies, and recommending improvements. Last year, we opened up a military and veteran student resource center in the student union to act as the on-campus central service point for military members and their families. And UAA is one of just 11 schools in the country that has been selected by the Department of Defense to participate in the Vet Success on Campus program, which places full-time VA coordinators on campus to work with our resource center servicing the military veteran students and their families. Now, in the short time that I've been with the university, the single issue I've heard about the most is transfer of credit. This is a subject that arouses great passion, and military transfer credit is just one piece of this bigger picture. Now, the Board of Regents has adopted a policy that we must accept and transfer as much credit as is appropriate to a student's new degree and under our graduation requirements. All three campuses have established transfer credit policies that are designed to give maximum credit for courses and training taken elsewhere, including in the military. We do believe that awarding appropriate credit for military training is one of our core responsibilities and another way we can show our commitment to our military and veteran students. Now, while testifying last year about this bill, I discovered that there was actually some tremendous misconceptions about what the university is doing, which is why I wanted to testify today, Mr. Chair. Transfer credit processes are managed at the campus level, although necessarily there's a great deal of uniformity in the system. All three campuses transfer credit based on recommendations made by ACE, which stands for the American Council of Education. ACE has had a contract with the Department of Defense since the end of World War II to review military training and experience for the award of equivalent college credit. Its recommendations on equivalent college credit are utilized by many schools across the country, and each of our three campuses have entered into a signed agreement with the Department of Defense to utilize the ACE recommendations. Our campuses are also members of the SOC Consortium. SOC stands for the Service Members Opportunity Colleges. This is a consortium of about 1,000 colleges and universities across the country that enroll military veterans and dependents in special degree programs, both on campus and through distance learning. Its purpose is to let military members actually get degrees instead of just accumulate credit as they transfer from base to base. We've signed written agreements with the other members of the consortium to follow specific guidelines to ease transferability of credit. For example, a student getting an associate's degree at UAA that is a part of this consortium degree program only needs 3 UAA credits to get the UAA degree. UAA will accept all the rest of the credits from other members of the SOC consortium. UAA is currently accepting about 51 credits on average from military students who have earned credit at any of the regionally accredited military schools, such as the Community College of the Air Force, the Service Academies, and others. At UAF, a student can use approximately 30 credits of typical training for the Bachelor of Emergency Management degree, or 90 credits for a General Studies BA that doesn't require any particular major requirements. Neither UAA nor UAF have any limitation on the number of military transfer credits that they'll award. They used to, but they did away with that in the last few years as part of our continuing effort to review the system and make it better. I could go on, but the bottom line, Mr. Chair, while I don't have figures for the entire system, UAA alone is awarding over 21,000 hours a year of military transfer credit for training, for education, and even just for time spent in the service. The number's increasing every year. As of this year, approximately 99.5% of the students who requested military transfer credit actually received the credits that they requested. Now, Alaska is widely known to service members as a state that welcomes and appreciates the military, and I think that Alaska's university, as demonstrated by our existing policies, reflects the prevailing social values here pretty accurately. I'd be happy to answer any questions the members might have.
Representative Rainbow.
Okay. First of all, thank you. I think this is an outstanding idea. I really do. But my first question is going to be, who does your follow-up? Do you do your own follow-up if we request information, or does somebody else that's with you?
I will follow up personally.
Okay, and I'll just tell you why, because in some of the subcommittee meetings for finance, we didn't get the information we requested, and now I'm trying to figure out exactly who's responsible for that follow-up. You said that UAA was military-friendly and rated number 5. I'd like to get that information. Also, you said that you talked about the SOC program. I'd definitely like to get information in regards to that as well. So you said that also that that approximately 51 credits are transferring, you know, from other schools. I just want to say thank you for working on the transfer credits. It's definitely a hot button for me and for many, many, many others. And so I'm really appreciative that you guys are making this a top, you know, priority. And when I see things like this, it makes me happy that we're actually moving in the right direction. So thank you.
And you have several veterans at the table, and I'll only speak for this one, but I appreciate it as well. I've got a feeling Representative Heron does too, but I'll let him speak for himself. I'd like to acknowledge we've been joined by Senator Cleck Bishop. Welcome to the room. Purgatory, I guess, today. But thanks again, Chris. Any further?
Yes. Yes, if I could just ask Mr. Christensen, unless your notes are sort of personal proprietary, I would love to just have a copy of your outline.
Certainly.
Thank you.
Yeah, if you could send Conrad, we'll disperse it, and we'll put it on our website for anybody in the room that cares to have a copy as well. Thanks again, Chris.
Thank you.
With that, we'll open it up to the rest of the room. Is there anybody in the room that has not signed up or has signed up that would like to testify on this bill? Nope. Oh, come on, Aaron. Seeing none, do we have online? We have Mark Sansusi, Department of Defense. Are you with us, Mark?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair.
Welcome for joining us today, and please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mark Sansusi. I'm the Department of Defense Regional Liaison for Military Families for the Northwest, working for the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Military Family and Community Policy. Thank you for the opportunity to call in and express Department of Defense support for House Bill 84. I've been watching and listening and agree with everything that Kim Skipper outlined and concur with what Mr. Christensen just briefed. And I'll just try and be value added here with my comments. 2 years ago, the Department of Defense began supporting efforts in all the states to give separating service members academic and occupational credits so they wouldn't be held back when trying to find employment or finishing degrees. And as Representative Newbold said, we've already been paying for all of this outstanding, in many cases, training by being federal taxpayers. Last year, you passed this same legislation when sponsored by Representative Thomas as HB 282, and it actually passed the full House unanimously on February 1st. Unfortunately, it languished on the Senate floor until April 15th, and then sine die came and went without final passage, so we were so ever close. We're doing these efforts in the states because of the unemployment rate. Primarily, in September 2012, over 736,000 veterans were unemployed, and the jobless rate for post-9/11 veterans was 9.9%, with a young male veteran aged 18 to 24 unemployment rate at around 18.1%. As Kim mentioned, 20 to 25 states have enacted new laws in the last couple of years, and we have an outstanding amount of bills being looked at in the 2013 session in 30-some-odd states and bits and pieces, whether it's just academic or occupational or both. So we appreciate you looking at this and hopefully getting us where we want to go this year. It's important to reemphasize that you know and other licensing folks know that we're not asking for direct licensure if it is not equivalent. In cases where the regulatory agency or board determines partial credit, but it saves time and expense and helps the veteran get there, even if not completely, that's what we seek. We are only seeking credit where credit is due. And another point to be made is that the more credit given to a veteran towards licensing or a degree or certification, the more school slots can be made available to civilians, especially in programs where you may have some waiting lists to get in. The Department of Defense recognizes that if we're going to ask credentialing bodies to evaluate military training and experience, we have to make it easier for them to do so. And in doing that, the DOD is working feverishly with the United States Department of Labor to link service transcripts of military occupations with civilian to private sector licensing requirements. And they're also working with 6 regulatory agencies and 6 pilot states to review and select military occupations, doing lots of crosswalk activities. So lots of progress is being made there. One point that Mr. Christensen did not bring up is that as of March 1st, the DOD has worked with the respective military services, and they have created a joint service transcript known as the JST, which will be a common purple transcript generic to all military services, meant to ease the burdens of translating one service's coding and descriptions of courses and training from another when they are evaluating academic transcripts. So this tool, the JST, will be an official transcript tool and will help standardize and unify and streamline the schools as they measure those credits. So with that, I will stop here and stand for any questions, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the opportunity.
Any questions? Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there anybody else online? Pardon me?
Still waiting for questions.
And we do have Jeff Selby online for questions, Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Anybody have any questions for Jeff? Seeing none, we're going to take a brief at ease. We have one member that really wanted to be here to vote on this bill, who is down the hall and should be here in a few minutes. We're back on the record, and again, one last time, anybody in the room that would care to testify on this bill? Seeing none. Anybody online? Seeing none. Close out public testimony. Bring it back to the committee for discussion. Any discussion? Representative Herron.
Mr. Chairman, last year it was URA. This year it's URA Radu.
Well, it's a tough act to follow. Any other comments? Seeing none, what are the wishes of the committee?
I move House Bill 84, Version A, from committee with individual recommendations and attached physical notes.
Seeing no opposition, the bill will move on to finance, and we will take a brief at ease to sign the document. We're back on the record. Next item on the calendar is House Bill 76, Unemployment. Electronic filing of labor information. With us to present the bill, we have Brian Keith and Paul Dick from the Department of Labor. And, oh, Commissioner, I'm sorry, Commissioner Bloomer. You don't mind me going off script, do you?
Not at all. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Welcome back.
Thank you. We're happy to be here today to present to you.
Well, please state your name and affiliation.
Oh, sorry, Diane Bloomer, Department of Labor and Workforce Development Commissioner. And we're here today to talk to you about House Bill 76. I'll have Acting Deputy Commissioner Bryn Keith and Director Paul Dick. We also have Aisha Paulson from the Department of Law online for questions. So because I know that the questions will probably get technical and detailed, I am going to go ahead and turn it over to Ms. Keith and Mr. Dick. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman.
Representative Millett.
I see that Senator Cliff Bishop is in here with his eagle eye making sure that...
And he got acknowledged faster than...
whatever. Whatever he implemented...
He's not hiding in the back row.
...doesn't get changed.
Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Yes, for the record, I'm Bryn Keith, and I'm Acting Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. And with me this morning is Paul Dick. He's the Director of our Employment Security Division. The bill before you, House Bill 76, broadly speaking, does four things. It allows for the electronic filing of reports and documents. It improves our ability to recoup fraudulent unemployment insurance payments. It adopts minor changes that bring us in conformity with the federal law that governs the unemployment insurance program. And it changes how unemployment insurance tax rates are set in order to keep more money in the hands of Alaska's employers and employees, keep more money circulating through our economy while conforming or protecting the integrity of our trust fund. I'd like to turn it over to Paul Dick to go through sectional analysis of the bill.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Paul Dick. I'm the Director of the Employment Security Division in the Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
And thank you for joining us today as well. And
thank you for the opportunity to be at the table here. I'd like to just walk through the bill, if I might, and give a little bit of analysis and commentary on each of the sections. Section 1 adds a new section authorizing the commissioner to use of electronic filing methods in place of paper. And this is really a measure to bring us kind of into the modern age, allow folks and employers to report using electronic standards, really an efficiency measure for the state to allow that electronic filing, and a benefit to employers, frankly, to allow them to do online business as they're so used to these modern days. Section 2 adds another new section authorizing the legislature to appropriate money into the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. And this is really introduced here in conjunction with the other parts of the bills
Sections 5 and 6, as I'll highlight later on here. Just allowing the legislature, just putting on record, if you will, the legislature to make appropriations to the trust fund. Section 3 is a conformity section of the bill, conforming to federal law, which essentially is to prohibit relief of charges for employers that are what we call reimbursable employers, which is essentially governmental agencies, state, federal governmental agencies, that we process their benefits and then charge them back for the benefits that we paid out. And I just want to highlight here that this section would apply to employers where there's what we call a repeated pattern of failure for untimely response to our requests. I would just at this point say that we have 200 governmental employers in contrast to 18,000 private employers, and we have not had any specific issue with the governmental employers responding to our requests. Section 4 repeals and reenacts Section 290F, which essentially has a table in it that talks to our solvency adjustment. We have, as part of our tax rate, a solvency adjustment, which looks at our unemployment insurance trust fund solvency in comparison to wages. And basically, this collapses the table into verbiage and also takes the calculation from tenths of a percent to hundredths of a percent, so a little bit more precise calculation. Section 5 authorizes the Commissioner of Labor and Workforce Development to eliminate or reduce increases in employment insurance tax rates. And I just want to emphasize that this section would only apply to given years where there's an increase in the tax rate, and conditional upon another measure we call the average high cost multiple, which is a measure of solvency calculated by the U.S. Department of Labor Employment and Training Administration, and that measure would be 0.8 or greater. So that condition has to apply, and then an increase in the tax rate. This section is intended to provide unemployment insurance tax relief to employers during times when the economy is in recession, deferring the taxes to subsequent years when the economy is growing and healthy. And it pertains only 2 years in which the tax rate is being increased. Section 6 brings the state into conformity with federal law to remove the department's authority to waive collection of a penalty established due to misrepresentation, and also then requires a minimum of 30% of unemployment insurance penalties collected due to misrepresentation to be deposited into the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. Currently, all those penalties go to the general fund, so this federal law conformity would dictate that we take 30% of those penalties and put them into the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund, which actually benefits the obviously the trust fund balance, which will help down the road mitigate tax increases for employers. Section 7 authorizes the department to participate in an offset program called the Treasury Offset Program. Currently, 21 states participate in this program. And this just gives us another tool for collection to offset. We already offset debts or liabilities through the PFD garnishment program. So this would expand this. And also, it would be really beneficial to the state because it gives us the authority to offset federal income tax refunds. This is what we would be offsetting. To offset federal income tax refunds from folks out of state. Currently, they're out of jurisdiction, so it's difficult to collect on them. Section 8 amends by adding a new amends 520 by adding a new paragraph to define covered employment compensation debt in accordance with federal statutory definition. Section 9 amends the uncodified law specifying that 279 Section 3 of this bill applies to overpaid benefits established after October 21, 2013, and that date is set there because it ties with federal law that requires enactment of that provision, conformity provision, by that date. And sections 10 through 12 deal with effective dates and authority to adopt regulation. I'd be glad to take questions.
Any questions?
Yes.
Representative Josephson.
Mr. Dick, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm looking at a chart prepared by your office on February 14th. It's called Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund Balances and Benefits Paid. Do you have that?
I do.
When I look at the actual fund balance, September 30th, I guess, 2012, in the left column, versus what would have occurred if this bill were in effect, the differences from 05 to 2010 are just fairly marginal, really, yeah, fairly marginal, and then they grow. Can you account for that? Why would there be virtually no difference in the net balance before 05, 06, 07, 08, and 09? And then a change, a pretty marked change. Does that make sense?
Through the chair, Representative Joseph, could you please restate the question? I'm sorry, I wasn't tracking.
Sure. I'm comparing the column on the left, basically the far left, with the column on the far right, and I'm trying to figure out what the net effect of this bill would be in relation to what exists now. And, for example, in 2009, the department, the fund balance for Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund was $319 million, and under this bill it would be $313 million. And I look at those numbers and I say that's not a whole lot of difference. But then, coming to the last year, it's $264 million, versus under this bill, $189 million. That's a significant difference. And so I'm curious, what happened around 2010 to make this disparity grow?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, there are a lot of moving parts in these calculations. Not only would we, under these scenarios, be suspending all of the tax increases during those periods, we also have what's called the solvency adjustment, which allows us to only increase to a certain degree or decrease to a certain degree. We also have penalties that flow into the fund. It's, as I said, lots of moving pieces. And what we're seeing towards the end of that time period on the 2012 is the cumulative result of those interplaying. I think what could be very helpful is if we go back further years and actually play this out over an extended period. I think that might help us see what's precisely occurring.
And through the chair, if I might add, is an event that happened in 2009 is we went into this recession, and so we see the effect of costs going up during these years, which has resulted in these last 3 years as increases in rates through the years. So I think this chart reflects that if 25 or Senate Bill or House Bill 76 were in effect, that kind of cumulative rate increases that would have taken each of those years. So I believe that's why you'll see that further decline in the balance. Now, I will say with House Bill 76, this is really a tax deferral program, so we would see that trust fund balance working its way back up to the targeted rate of 3% over the years when the economy is growing again and rates are would have been going down. So it's kind of a concept of tax deferral, and in these subsequent years, assuming we're beyond the recession and the economy is growing and one of the moving parts in the overall formula of the tax rate is benefit costs compared to wages. So as those benefits, as more people are employed, employment rate goes down, more people are employed, our costs go down. Normally in those years, we would see a tax decrease, but because of that trust fund factor trying to work its way back up to a targeted rate, we'll see that in play in those subsequent years, and so essentially deferring that tax increase into subsequent years.
Paula?
Several. Can I just sort of...
Just run right through them.
Okay. What is the maximum amount that a person in Alaska can receive per month in unemployment?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, $370 a week is the maximum amount. The minimum is 56.
Say that again?
Minimum benefit is $56 a week.
And how do we compare at $370 a week maximum with other states?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, we're pretty much kind of in the middle of the pack. There are states, I know, I was looking at one state recently, it's $555. We're at $370. I think roughly we're in the middle of the pack. Maybe a little bit above the middle, but kind of tending towards the middle of the pack.
Has the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund ever been insolvent?
Through the chair, it has not ever been insolvent since statehood, at least.
All right. And doesn't the current system allow for flexibility for peaks and valleys in the economy right now, for boom and bust cycles?
Through the chair, the current system does through that solvency adjustment. It's always looking, well, it's looking at the cost, so that's a major part of it also, but it always is looking at that trust fund solvency. So as the economy weakens, we generally tend to see the trust fund balance decrease because we're not collecting as fast as we're paying out the benefits. And then it's that reverse during the when the economy is on the upswing, we're seeing that we're paying less out on the upswings and the tax rate normally decreasing. So there is that fluctuation, and we've certainly seen that fluctuation throughout the years. I think there's a table in here that shows the rates over years, from a high of 4.84 to a low of 1.65, and you'll see in those in between years the kind of ups and downs of the rates as it's adjusting. If you overlaid a chart of the economy and recessions, I think you would see a relationship there.
Follow up or new question?
Just a few more. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Why don't you just run right through them, and that'll speed things up.
Sure. The current system allows for some departmental flexibility, right, in terms of the rates. I'm looking at the chart you referred to, the employer-employee rates. The department has discretion now, to some degree, to increase or decrease as it needs to. Is that right?
Through the chair, the rates are established through statute. It's a formula-driven, defined statutory, so we don't have that discretion at this time.
And what does the federal government do in the event the state undercollects? What is the federal government's practice where there's an undercollection and a greater demand for unemployment?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, the feds are, they have, I guess you'd call them guidelines out there for looking at trust funds. Several states have gone, first of all, there is nothing specifically as far as a penalty or anything to states for going under. However, in the federal unemployment program, we're required to pay benefits. So we have seen states, as much as 32 states, have to borrow from a federal account to pay their benefits, and then subsequently, of course, have to pay the federal government back with interest. And so that's the experience other states have had.
And, I mean, the obvious question that begs is, how did that happen to those 32 states, and how do we avoid that happening?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I'm not
really familiar with those states' unemployment insurance programs, systems, what kind of system they have. I believe a lot of it's been driven by their economy, recessions in those states. To give you an idea, California currently owes $10 billion. Michigan is another big one, and I think it's much driven by their recessions and economies. I haven't studied the interplay between the systems and their economies.
Okay. And just as a last question, so Mr. Dick, what you're telling me is we're one of 18 states that's never been in that situation. Whatever we've got, it hasn't put us into insolvency such that we had to borrow from the feds and pay back with interest.
Through the chair, Representative Judson, that's correct.
I have another question.
Representative Reinbold.
I just want to make a few comments. One, the electronic filing, I think that's a great idea. I think, you know, it's an obvious in this age of technology. Also, this bill helps us be federally compliant, which to me is so basic, it's so logical. Also, helping businesses be more sustainable over the long term. I mean, as many of us know, we're not doing so well compared to other states in regards to being competitive, and anything we can do to, you know, help maintain and sustain our businesses. And last, there's no cost to the department, and it just seems like this is going to streamline, make things more efficient. So I just really want to say thank you for bringing this bill forward.
Representative Mullet, any questions?
I'm good.
Thanks again. Representative Schnault.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, just a couple, I guess, questions or concerns. I know that Section 5 gives the commissioner a lot of leeway in suspending in whole or parts of the unemployment rates, and I guess my concern, or is there any concern about just the 0.3% being able to adjust that yearly, regardless of what happens with the unemployment rates?
Through the chair, Representative Chenault, we believe currently the structure is such that the trust fund solvency adjustment can only increase by 0.3%. per year or decrease 0.3% a year. And we believe that this, actually Section 5 would remove that, or excuse me, 4 would remove that 0.3% decrease aspect. So it still have the 0.3% increase, which is intended to provide some protection to employers to stair step and gradually increase the, in years of increase the rate. But we believe that with the when the economy recovers, that the 3% limitation on decreases should be eliminated to allow employers more tax relief, get more money into the economy to help the economy grow even more.
And Mr. Chairman, just I guess another question or comment, and I may show my ignorance there, but when the federal government extends unemployment benefits, who pays?
Through the chair, Representative Chenault, federal benefits that we pay out are 100% reimbursed by the federal government.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? We also have one more person from the Department of Labor that was signed up to testify. Byron Keith.
Oh,
or is it questions only?
Brenda.
Oh, Brenda.
Yeah.
Can't even read it.
Common problem.
Probably not.
It's been that kind of a day.
Interesting.
Or night last night. I think we got out of here about 11 last night. With that, I think I'll open it up to public testimony if there's no further questions for the Department of Labor. Don Etheridge, come on up. Well, I'd like to acknowledge that we've been joined by Representative Isaacson someplace. There he is. Yep. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Don Etheridge with the Alaska State AFL-CIO. And we're supportive of most all the bill except for Section 5 is our only concern. We do think that if somebody is fraudulent with the bill and the other sections, go after them. We don't like fraud. But under Section 5, we have concerns that we're adding politics into a formula-driven process that has worked for many, many years. And as you've heard here, we don't have to go to the feds for any money. We're solvent, and we're in good shape. And with the fact that we're talking of state budget cuts, federal budget cuts, we're looking at cuts to the capital budget, we're liable to be needing some of those funds this year with people that are not going to be getting the work that we normally get. A lot of our construction trades, that's what they depend on in the wintertime to try to survive the winter so that we don't lose them and have them all going south when we have a cut in the capital budget. That's going to make a major hurt on us. And we just think that politics introduced into a program that's worked is the wrong way to go. And if there's a problem with it, let's look at the calculations on it. Let's don't introduce politics to it. I was told to keep it short, and I'm doing that.
By somebody that wasn't a member of this committee?
Yes, sir.
Representative Millett.
Thank you. Good morning, Don. Good to see you. I guess I'm confused on why you think politics would play a role in this rather than an economic decision on whether we're collecting too much unemployment or not collecting enough. I don't understand how it would be a political decision and not basically an economic decision to give relief when needed. So I'm confused by that statement because I don't see how Section 5 politicizes the decision when you're moving the rate, so it's such a small increment. And so I don't know if that was, I guess I want you to explain to me how you think it's a political maneuver.
But when you have somebody that's involved in the political scheme, such as the commissioner, making that decision, then that's when I believe that it can become political if the pressure's on the commissioner at that time to reduce it, whether or not it can afford to be reduced, it could happen.
Follow up. So I guess that would be, I don't understand why that decision I don't think would ever be made. I don't think there's a scenario where the commissioner would ever put the fund in jeopardy at all. I think that it's exact opposite. I think it would be the reduction would come in a time of when the economy needs some adjustment. I guess I'm confused on how you think it's a political decision and not an economic decision. That bothers me a little bit because it's not always about politics. It's about what's best for the economy and best for the employer and the employee. And it's not a political decision. I don't think that there's any commissioner or any governor that would ever put our unemployment insurance benefits in a position where we had to go beg the federal government for money or that we weren't solvent. So I guess I'm a little put off by those comments.
Through the chair, Representative Millett, I would hope that would be the truth, but I have concerns. Let me put it that way.
Fair enough.
Any further questions for Mr. Etheridge? Thanks again, Don. Paul Grassi, welcome back. Been a while. Please state your name and affiliation for the record, and you got our undivided attention.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and the committee. For the record, I'm Paul Grassi. I am up here representing the plumbers and pipe fitters and also the iron workers. And, I don't want to go over a whole lot of things with this because we have the same concerns. We believe that the bill is basically good. We support the vast majority of the bill. We think it's just a housekeeping bill that will help the department do the job better and to comply with federal requirements. So, but we do have some concerns over Section 5. Let me just back up a little bit on this. The formula was put in place over 30 years ago and actually was designed by the Director of Finance for the legislature, David Teal. It's worked perfectly for over 30 years. We've never had an insolvency. So our concern is, and I don't want to get overly dramatic about this, because I think in the good times, there won't be a problem, you know, that it would be good to get employers money. But my concern is that it could lead to some underfunding. And if there's a drastic downturn in the economy, then it could lead to insolvency. Or, you know, add to the possibility of insolvency. I won't say it will lead to insolvency, but the downturn itself would be the big problem. But it can add some problem with it. So the way the fund works, there's a 3-year look back period. There's various parts to the formula that lessen the increase and the decrease in taxes to the employer and to the employees in our state. It's designed to keep the peaks and valleys from, you know, leveling out the peaks and valleys. So my concern would be that we put it just a little bit more at risk. If there is a problem, and you know, say the, I guess, two things. My clients have employers, and we represent those employers as well. So we want the employers to get the benefit of this. However, we're not sure how much benefit this will be. I was looking at this, and I think I'm doing kind of a guesstimate on this, but I think it's going to be amount to about $30 to $40 a year per employee. I don't know if that's a lot of money. It would help, but it's, you know, it's not a great amount of money for the potential risk. However, if the formula is such that it's overfunding, you know, then I would suggest that we change the formula. David Teal is here. No one knows it better than David Teal. Look at it, and if in fact there's, you know, a need to change the formula, do it. But don't put it in the hands of one person. I mean, I've met the new commissioner. I trust her. She seems like a good person. I don't think anybody would do anything to harm the fund. However, we don't know. You know, it's a guess as to what's going to happen the following year with the economy. And if you leave it to those persons, we don't know. And we don't know who the future commissioners are going to be either. So I would suggest that if, in fact, the formula is not working correctly or is overfunding, then look at it. And if it needs to be changed, change it. But do it with you. This is your job to do this. It's not. It shouldn't be the Commissioner of Labor to do this. You know, you're the people that deal with the purse strings. And if there is a problem with the fund, you should look at it and change it so that you're not putting the fund at risk. Oh, and I would like to make one other statement about helping the employers here. And I don't think this was really stated. If the fund goes insolvent, then yes, the feds will step in, or they will make the fund, or they will allow for the benefits to be paid. They will pay for the benefits. However, the state will have to reimburse them immediately with interest, but it isn't the state that's reimbursing them. It's the employers. You know, the employers will be the ones that get charged with this. It's not the state. You know, it's not the state's money. It's the employer's money. And so my concern is that while you're trying to help the employers, you may be putting them at risk. So I would suggest that you look at this and look at it thoroughly. And with that, I would answer, attempt to answer any questions.
Well, I think I'd make a statement first. I think the commissioner did the right thing. She brought it to the committee in the form of the bill that we have before us. And I believe Representative Millett has at least one question, and we've got two questions for you at least.
So what you're saying is that you trust David Teal. Would you rather David Teal be the man who makes the adjustments? I mean, I don't think we need to rewrite the formula. I mean, we're just asking for a small the latitude to make a small adjustment. But is your problem that it's the Commissioner of Labor that's doing it? Because what I hear is that you indicated that maybe she's not the appropriate person to do it, but David Teal, who's apparently the grandfather of the how we calculate unemployment insurance, would be
godfather.
Sorry, I don't want to make him old. He probably's going to call me later. The godfather of the unemployment formula. So is the problem that it's the department of it's the commissioner that's doing it, and that maybe I don't know. I feel like this is a it's not a big ask, and it's not something that we're ever going to. No one ever wants to make the fund insolvent. I mean, it's a small increment, and the benefit to the employers is, you know, like you said, it's minimal, but still, in times of lower the economy, when the economy is bad, this seems like a pretty smart thing for us to be looking at. So is it the commissioner you don't want doing it, or is it David Teal that one that you think that should be doing it? Because I don't understand. I think the commissioner is a nice lady too, but she's the one that handles the unemployment insurance in our department structure.
Representative Miller, through the chair, I didn't mean to come off. I certainly trust the commissioner. I think she's a very nice lady. It's not bad at all, and I'm not saying that. I'm saying that, you know, the formula has worked. And if the formula needs adjustment, and I would suggest that you look at that. It's not David Teal. It's just that obviously he designed a very good system. It's never had an insolvency. I mean, while while states in the lower 48, California, and you can go through a whole number of them, have had these insolvencies, our state has not. And we've had some pretty bad, severe downturns in our economy, like the mid-80s, and it survived the mid-80s. And, I would suggest that we couldn't, we could have this again. We could have an economy like we had in the mid-80s. And so the good thing about a formula is it really looks at the funding, it looks at the fund, it looks at the number of employees, it looks at the whole gamut of factors, and it determines what is needed. And if not as much is needed, then we can change the formula, keep it doing what it's doing, and still give the employers a break.
Again, I think this is in the commissioner's job description to be able to do something like this. I do not believe, as much as I like David Teal, I don't think this is in his current job description to do this. To clarify that point. And again, I think Representative Herron has a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Several.
No, just one. The 60-second rule by our vice chair. I came in, I was absent with part of this discussion, so I came in when Don was talking. So the question to you, Paul, is about Section 5. And so I listened carefully. It seems like you have an issue or concern with the section. So you go to line 20, line 23, and line 26, and it says may suspend in whole or in part. So is your problem with the in whole? Should we put... Just have in part with sideboards? I guess that's what I think I'm hearing you say.
Well, I'm Representative Herron through the chair. I am saying that I really don't know, and that's why I would say, and I don't know that it has to be David Teal. It could be the department, the actuaries, maybe with David Teal, to look at the formula. look at the formula and determine if in fact, it, you know, that there's a need to change it so that the fund, you know, it, that the employers get the break that, that you're trying to give them, but it does it in a way that doesn't put the fund at risk. I don't know that, I don't want to make this too dramatic because I don't mean to. Chances are it would, in, especially during the good times, it would be fine to give this money to them. It's just that I think if you change, you know, if it's overfunding, which I think is what it seems like that it's being said here, that could be done through a formula, and then it's good for, you know, 30 more years, and we don't have to deal with this, or no one really no one has to deal with this. And so that's kind of what I'm saying. The answer, I don't know, I don't have the answer to this. I'm just saying have the department actuaries, have David Teal look at it and see if there's a way of just changing the formula to make it safe so there aren't any risks and still give the employers a break.
Paul, new question?
Not really a question. Thank you for your answers. I guess, Mr. Chairman, I'm going back and looking at the backup, and I'm seeing, reading the comments, and it seems that if we go back to Section 5, what I read into the letters that are in the backup and to the comments by the last two people that testified is maybe we should look at dropping in whole, but keeping in part, and then the legislature put sideboards on it. That's what I read in the testimony in written form and in verbal today. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And it's not my intent to move the bill today. I think there is a lot, we're going to have at least one more day devoted to public testimony. Representative Miller.
Thank you. So I'm going to read a statement, and I want you to tell me if you agree or disagree with the statement. Is that okay? I'm sitting next to an attorney, which is really bad because, you know, now you're rubbing off on me. So,
I will attempt to do that.
Okay.
You're taking a third of a sandwich?
I'm taking a third of a sandwich. Okay, so here's the statement, and I want you to tell me if you agree or don't agree. House Bill 76 revises the contribution requirements to keep the trust fund solvent and allows the commissioner the authority to eliminate or reduce increases in the unemployment insurance tax rate when the fund is fully funded based on standards to ensure the actuary soundness of the unemployment trust fund.
Representative Miller, through the chair, I agree that that's the intent of the bill. The question I have is, and I don't know the answer to this, and this is why I'm concerned. I'm not saying this is an absolute fact and this is going to happen, but my concern is, is it going to be? How do we know for a fact that it's going to be solvent? The fund is going to be solvent. This is going to be allowed without. I mean, it could. It's like Don said. We don't know. I mean, it's hard to say. If a person knows what none of us know what the future is going to be, and so I would say, if it's reducing the amount of the funds itself, the amount that's in the fund, then if we do hit a downturn in the economy, we want to make sure there's enough funds in there so that our employers, we're not hurting the employers while we're trying to help them, is I guess what I'm saying here. And so I think that Representative Herron's concepts that he came up with would at least make that less of a possibility. And so I would say he's, at least that's in the right, moving in the right direction.
Follow up? I guess I just have a problem with, I have the voice of the small business, the National Federation of Independent Businesses, which represents small businesses that would probably help the most, saying they support this, and then unions, sorry, the last two people were representing unions, saying that they're in fear of a commissioner of labor who's very aware of the state of our fully funded unemployment fund not being able to make a small adjustment. It's just, it baffles me, Mr. Chairman. Sorry.
We certainly can't have you baffled.
It happens all the time, so, you know.
Mr. Chair, I apologize for baffling you. I didn't mean that at all.
Well, it's just this contradictory between the union and the people, the small business owners that, you know, could probably, this would affect the most, and, you know.
Representative Mill, through the chair, we represent small employers also, so I do want to, I agree with what you're saying. We do want to help them. We just want to also make sure that we're not hurting them at the same time and hurting the fund at the same time.
So you're worried about negligence?
No, I wouldn't say negligence. I would never ascribe to malice what can be explained by lack of knowledge.
I'm not going to speak for the commissioner, but I will give her a chance in a few minutes to respond. But I would have to think that her goal and the one you just stated are probably real similar. I don't think she has anything other than the best interest of the state and what she's attempting to do with this. Representative Reinbold, do you have
I do.
Questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, we've sat through a lot of testimony, a lot of hours every day, and this is the first time I can say that there's some insinuations and there's potential distrust that's being, you know, the undercurrents, which I don't think are appropriate. I know the commissioner, and I know that she has a reputation of working well with labor, and I don't know if you're suggesting that if this female commissioner that we have right now, that we're going to have a problem with insolvency if they're in charge. And I'm going to go and I'm going to also say, you know, that the NFIB is supportive of this, and we need to support our small businesses, and I think they're a really loud voice for our small businesses right now, and I think, you know, that letter is speaking very, very loud and clear. But anyway, I just had to speak my piece.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'm puzzled by, with great respect to my colleagues, Representatives Reinbold and Millett, it's as if they're saying, geez, there's a difference of opinion between management and labor. This is shocking. And I don't find it shocking. It's the history of humanity. It goes back to the guilds in the 1700s. And so I'm just, of course there's a difference. I woke up knowing that. I take Mr. Grossi's comments as just being concerned about some employers who he represents, but also
perhaps this would be better served in the when we get to committee comments rather than question for Mr. Grossi. Are there any further questions for Paul? Thanks again, Paul.
Thank you.
Commissioner, would you care to respond to anything that's come up in the last few minutes? And I'm appalled that somebody would think that a political decision is occasionally made in this building.
Once in a while.
Chair Olson, for the record, again, Diane Bloomer, Commissioner for Department of Labor. And I guess what I will just say to the group here today is that although it lists the Commissioner of the Department of Labor as the decision maker, I can't imagine that decision would ever be made in a vacuum. So as we look at what's in the best interest of the state, those of you who know this administration and know our governor knows that he's not interested in putting us in a situation where we would have to borrow from the federal government. So there's sideboards on this bill already that define when that decision can be made in conjunction with the actuary. So the decision would never be made in a vacuum, and it would not be made harmful to the business owners of this state. And I think all of you who know this administration know that wouldn't be the case.
Any questions for the commissioner while we're over at the table? Thanks again.
Thank you.
Anybody else in the room that is not signed up that would care to testify on this bill? And again, we'll be holding public testimony open. We have one person online at least, Douglas Holmes. Doug Holmes, Washington, D.C., are you still with us?
I am. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, please state your name and affiliation, and thank you for taking the time to participate today.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Doug Holmes. I'm president of the National Foundation for Unemployment Compensation and Workers' Compensation. I also serve as president of UWC, an organization that monitors unemployment insurance policy and law at the federal and state level. My background is as a UI administrator, legal counsel, and secretary of the advisory council for the Ohio system, and then retired from state service and became president of this national organization. We watch these issues very closely, oftentimes consult with states about solvency efforts related to unemployment insurance. NFIB contacted me to just take a look and give some perspective about the language that's particularly in sections 4 and 5 of this bill, and give some perspective about how Alaska fits with respect to federal guidelines and also relative to other states. And I think, and I've been watching the committee, and I think you're in good, Alaska is in a very good place as compared to many other states as far as solvency is concerned in your trust fund. As far as the section 05 or section 5, just to give you a frame of reference, the 0.8 average high cost multiple in my rough calculations equates to about $230 million. So you would, even if you hit the 0.8, you would still have $230 million about in your trust fund, which is a fairly good balance in your trust fund given your history of benefit payout. I think that the risk of insolvency would be minimal, if not non-existent. So I think that that's a reasonable place to place the review for the actuary and the commissioner, and gives you some flexibility that enables the state to respond. One of the issues that always comes up in these areas, state by state, is what's the appropriate trust fund balance and what's the impact on our ability to keep money in the state and maybe use it for job creation or to reduce the cost of employment to bolster the economy. And I would just say that it is a judgment call, but at the moment, looking at Alaska, your tax per employee, I should say, as a percent of total wages is relatively high compared to other states. Your trust fund is high. It is seems as though it would be an appropriate time to take a look at flexibility. And this language in section 5, I think, is suitable. I think it doesn't put you at any risk. It gives you flexibility. So I think it's, you should also know that the interest rate right now that's being provided for balances in your trust fund is about 2.5%. If that money could be used for something better in your local economy, it might be. But that's the rate that you're getting now, and that interest is applied to the trust fund itself. So these are dedicated dollars that are part of the federal unified budget, can't be used for other purposes, so there is some restriction. The more money you put into the trust fund, it may improve your overall solvency, but that's also money that's maintained only in the federal unified budget and can't be used for other purposes if there's some need to do that. So that's the overall sense. When you look at the rest of the country, you're in very good shape in terms of trust fund as a percent of total wages, and you're also in good shape in terms of average high cost multiple. Even if you went down to 0.8 as the measure, you would still have approximately $230 million to start with in your trust fund. So I hope that gives you some sense about the rest country and what this would mean. That concludes my testimony.
Any questions for Mr. Holmes? Well, thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And I can't believe there's anybody else online. And with that, we're going to hold the bill over and keep public testimony open and take a... we're back on the record, and the last item we have on the calendar today is the continuation of the House Bill 74, the ADA bill, and we've got a new presentation by ADA, and who's going to be doing it? Sarah?
Both of us, Mr. Chairman.
Come on up. Sarah and Ted. They're Ted and Sarah. Please state your names and affiliations for the record. You've got our undivided attention probably for 15 minutes, 20 minutes. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Sarah Fisher Good. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Energy Authority. And with me is Ted Leonard. He's the Executive Director of ADA, and we're it's actually a pleasure to be back in front of House Labor and Commerce. It's been a while since I've worked on the ADA bill, and I'm pleased to present where we're at with the policy presentation on developing a liquefied natural gas proposal to bring it to the Fairbanks area. So, Mr. Chairman, House Bill 74 is really about developing a catalyst and a financing package with the strength of ADA to provide low-cost North Slope natural gas and propane to interior Alaska. This package provides an opportunity for this project to happen. It does not necessarily mean the project will happen. There are a lot of assumptions made. There's a lot of work going on with respect to whether this project will work out as anticipated. However, I think this presentation will show you where we're at with the project development and where we think we can significantly make a difference with the financing package to provide lower cost heating fuel, in particular to interior residents. So again, House Bill 74 does provide the catalyst to help make this happen, and it provides ADA some additional tools to help develop the package. It is primarily a financing package that is before you. So, again, it is to help build out the LNG to interior Alaska consumers, bring liquefied natural gas through a trucking process to consumers, and while assuring that the private sector is utilized as much as possible through this process. So, the brief project description is that the intention is that the natural gas would be liquefied on the North Slope and trucked to interior Alaska, and propane would also be produced and delivered to the interior. The primary initial portion of this is to serve Fairbanks directly and North Pole area, but then also be made available for other parts of interior Alaska. The LNG is to be stored and regasified in the interior, and the distribution system will be built out to supply natural gas for heating. And this distribution system is also going to be the distribution system that will lay the foundation that when there is a gas line that does come to the interior through the state, would be available, and these customers would be available to then transition to have their gas not trucked into the community, but distributed directly from the pipeline. This is just the value chain that's been developed, and this is the work that both ADA and AEA and the technical team has been working to develop and to work with the offerers. ADA had a letter of interest that went out earlier this year. We have been working with the proposers and the responders of that letter to help develop the package and also start the initiation of the due diligence on developing this project. So this slide is to really look at what we are seeing currently with the cost of energy, especially heating fuel, interior Alaska, and what we think this project can do to make a significant difference for many customers in the interior region. The fuel oil slide, as you see right now, is roughly $4 per gallon, and this project proposal has the wholesale LNG cost and the assumptions at roughly $3.50 an MCF. We have used that based upon information that has come in from project proponents. We do know that there are natural gas contracts available from the North Slope in order to provide gas at that price. The liquefaction plant is part of the blue part of the cost, and then the trucking component is the green part of the bar charts. What we do see with the yellow portion is the regas storage in the distribution section, and that actually brings the natural gas to the home. So this is at startup, this is the cost that we see, where we think we can reduce the cost through this proposal to take the fuel oil from the $4 to roughly reduce it almost by 50% to interior residents. So one of the questions that came up the last time that this bill was in front of House Labor and Commerce was, why not an electricity future? Why are there not other alternatives? And what we wanted to demonstrate in this slide is what you'd have to have electricity costs per kilowatt hour to actually even come close to being a potential for a heating solution. And as you can see, electricity would have to be 4 to 6 cents per kilowatt hour in order to make that competitive with the trucking portion. I've actually really appreciated that our economist has helped develop this slide, because you can see where heating costs in Fairbanks right now, Fairbanks electricity is 22 cents per kilowatt hour, and you can see the significant increase, or the significant difference on electricity as an alternative right now versus where fuel oil is at the moment, and then why we're looking at the trucking proposal. So this slide is to start discussing the startup costs and the distribution of the facility. The initial plant we are looking at is a 9 BCF plant that would provide 4.5 BCF for space heat, potentially 2 BCF for electric, and 2.5 for industrial use, having a total demand of 9 BCFs. At this initial startup, we really do think that the customers that would be eligible for this, that we're looking at for the initial build-out, is 7,800 customers for LNG, and then propane would be 1,800. And as you can see, as the plant would expand, that would increase to the 15,900 LNG customers and potentially 2,700 propane customers. So the capital cost of the plant, as we are looking at this, is the estimated costs of the plant are roughly $220 million with the regas and storage and the distribution roughly $220 on that part of that slide, to have the total startup cost of being $425 million. And Mr. Chairman, our estimates here are really based upon the project proponents that have started to develop this project last year. They were this is not a new concept that ADA and AEA came up this year. This was something that has been discussed in the past couple of years with respect to how we could actually get a cheaper fuel source to the Fairbanks area. So again, these assumptions are actually being vetted, and the due diligence is starting with Ted's team on the technical discussion of the project. So this slide does also provide a scenario too of where we are at with current monthly fuel oil bills in interior versus what the range of the fuel oils will potentially be with the natural gas future. And again, this is to really demonstrate why we think that this, you know, with AIDA's mission, or AEA's mission is to reduce the cost of energy for Alaskans. AIDA is the development financing agency for the state. This is a very good marriage of the two entities, sister agencies, to really develop a project to help pursue this for interior Alaskans, and using the strength of AIDA to help make this happen. And you can see this is the slide that really shows you why we're pursuing this. There's a significant heating cost, and we can actually see a very significant savings if we are able to provide LNG truck to Fairbanks at this point. Also changing from oil heat to LNG does provide also a reduction in the uncertainty of the price. So this slide is to demonstrate that if you have a fuel oil future, you can see where there's a real direct correlation. When Alaska North Slope crude increases in prices, your cost per fuel will go up directly. And this is actually what we saw starting in roughly 2008, where we started to see a significant increase in, you know, although ANS crude increased in price, at the same time, Alaskans on diesel heat were seeing a significant increase in their cost to heat their homes. And, of course, in the interior, it's one of the colder parts of the state, interior and rural Alaska, of course. And so with an LNG future, you can see where you significantly reduce the swing in prices, that although there is anticipated to be increased costs as gas prices, as crude prices fluctuate, we see a significant difference that even at the high estimated cost, you're still seeing significant savings from a diesel fuel. There's also the air emission issue, where the PM2.5 has been a significant concern in interior Alaska, and so natural gas will help increase the public health benefits substantially in the area. And so, Mr. Chairman, also one of the things that we have heard and the concern about developing this project is, as a pipeline happens, well, what happens to this infrastructure? Are we going to have a bunch of abandoned infrastructure, or infrastructure that's no longer necessary to be used? But what we do see is that as the space heating and existing space heating that is currently there, and electrical generation, and the existing industrial, all of those entities can still be served by the pipeline. The pipeline replaces then the trucking system. However, the plant and facility, the liquefaction facility, is something that is movable and can continue to serve areas in which a pipeline would not serve. And so we do think that there is a real significant industrial development that can be done post-pipeline, and then also further expansion of rural Alaska into the highway system and to the river system in order to continue to supply LNG to and propane to other areas of the state.
I have a question.
I think we're going to let her go. Okay.
And then, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to turn it over to Ted Leonard to go through the more specifics on the financing package for AIDA.
I'd like to make one brief comment. I'd like to acknowledge, I believe, one of the co-sponsors of the bill, Representative Steve Thompson from Fairbanks, who I think has a vested interest in this bill. And if I could ask one quick question, then we'll let you go through the rest of your presentation. What is the approximate time that Mr. Thompson will have gas in his electric, new gas range?
Well, we're actually hoping, Mr. Chairman, that one of the last slides that we're hoping, if everything pencils out, that this project is able to move forward and we are able to develop the financing package, that by the last quarter of 2015, we'd like to see first gas into the system. Now, the distribution, I actually do not know where Representative Thompson lives, but...
Do you live downtown?
Downtown.
Okay. Thanks. Please continue.
Okay. To the chair again, my name is Ted Leonard. I'm the executive director of AIDA. What this bill does do is provide authorization for AIDA to participate in the financing through two actual separate streams of funding. One stream is that we're able to provide direct financing of $275 million to the project, and that's broken out between loans provided through ADA issuing bonds, $150 million of bonds, and the rate on that direct financing would be the bond rate plus 25 basis points that ADA will have for managing the project. And then also a direct financing of $125 million that would be at 3% that's set in statute. And then also in the governor's proposed capital budget is another $50 million that the purpose of that is to bring down directly the cost to the consumers in interior Alaska, which would be an equity investment by the state in some type of public partnership, public-private partnership. And then as you can see on this slide, it's just providing a more detailed view of how the funding sources would work in the initial build-out that the state's going to be involved in, which includes a total of $355 million. One of the parts that wasn't mentioned in the other slide is that based on statute that was passed last year, there are credits that can be used in both the distribution side of this project and on the production side involving credits. That there's credits for providing LNG storage, and there will both be LNG storage on the North Slope side and then on the Fairbanks distribution side where you're going to have regasification. This. Mm-hmm. And the next slide is just an estimate of how ADA believes that the financing tools would be used for again. Again, the financing that ADA is requesting to participate would be involved in the initial build-out. That would be the initial $425 million. With then the community and the utilities would provide the full financing for the expansion going from a 9 BCF plant to a 13.5 BCF plant. So on here it shows that we believe that there'd be a direct loan for the production facility of $125 million, that the general fund appropriation would go into the investment as an equity portion for the state, and then there'd be funding by the storage credit. And then also, that's very important, is that for this project to work, both on the production side and on the distribution side, there has to be private investment of approximately, we're estimating, $70 million out of the $425 million. Okay. And then the next slide is just a slide that we showed to give the committee an idea of the different breakdowns of the cost for bringing gas to Fairbanks area, not including the distribution. How much interest would be out of the 1028 per MCF that we're estimating? 25 cents. The principal on the loan would be 46 cents. Return on equity, 21 cents. And then you can see the majority of the cost to bring the gas to Fairbanks is in the trucking, the natural gas contract, and then a small amount for the actual operations. And then in the end is a projected timeline for the project. Going through the feasibility stage will happen through, actually happening right now, from February to August. Then we'll be working on the plant and storage starting in June with gas delivery first in the last quarter of 2015, and then building out the distribution system in 2014 and 2015. A quick update, ADA and AEA has had a team up in Fairbanks meeting with the proponents, the project sponsors, the ones who answered the RFI last week. We had 3 days of meetings. We have two engineering firms on board right now to start analyzing the different proposals from turnkey proposals from project sponsors, HDR, and then another firm called MEI. And the MEI is an expert on building liquefaction plants. They built approximately 300 across the world. And so, and then also having financial advisors to start looking at the financial feasibility of the plant. So that will be going on through from through June. And again, with the final goal to have first gas delivered at the end of 2015.
Well, I think the first set of questions have come from Representative Reinbold, followed by Speaker Chenault, followed by Representative Josephson. You're up.
Right now?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I've got a lot of questions. It would have been easier for me if I could have asked them, you know, along the way.
Then we'd be halfway through the presentation. We're on the floor for a third of the way.
Yeah, so I guess I'm gonna jump into one of the later slides. You said that there were going to be converting, you know, the houses are going to be converting to be able to receive, you know, this gas. Do you have an estimate of when these houses will be ready and how much per household it's going to cost?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, the estimates that we have heard is there has been a range of estimates about, you know, 300 to 500 potential per household, and then with the conversion, because of the significant savings that you see with respect to what could be saved annually, we do think that there is a significant incentive for some conventional financing to be able to help handle the conversion costs that would be necessary. And again, since we are working through the due diligence, I wouldn't expect folks in Fairbanks to start doing this until we actually get through the due diligence and get to be more of a situation where we truly do have a project and that these numbers do get proven up that this is the type of savings that we'll continue to that we would be able to see.
Okay, and on your potential finance options for initial build out.
Is that a pause?
Please, yeah. Yes. The private investment of $70 million. Who's that money coming from?
Through the chair to Representative Reinbold. That money would be coming from the project sponsors, whichever one would be a sponsor in the production facility. We believe that would be one of the utilities right now that would be as project sponsor. And then on the storage side, it would be from the different utilities investing in the distribution system. That would include Fairbanks Natural Gas, and the new utility, IGU, Interior Gas
Utility. Yeah, Interior Gas Utility.
So this type of project is the type of project that ADA is involved in right now, that as we invest our money, we expect the project sponsor to also invest their money. So as a combination of the funds are used to do the build-out and the construction of the project itself.
Follow-up? New question?
Another follow-up. When you said that this was a movable facility, can you tell me where it would possibly go, how much it would cost?
And the good part is it skid-mounted, or how is it movable? I mean, do you dismantle it and rebuild it?
Yes. This to the chair, to Representative Reinbold. I do not have the cost yet of how much it would cost to move it, but this is a modular facility. Sort of you build it in parts, so you bring the parts up and you would construct it. It can be moved the same way as you brought the parts up through the Dalton Highway, or you would move them back down. One of the potentials would be to move it to Fairbanks next to wherever the pipe will come in at, and then it would be a customer to utilize LNG or gas coming off the pipe to make LNG that would then be trucked to, as we stated, mining operations. For example, the Ambler Mining District is supposed to be coming online in 2019. There's other mining areas up there that have stated that they would rather go from a diesel set to a LNG set if it's possible. And then trucking down the Richardson Highway. But I do not know what the cost would be. That would be part of the due diligence. But for keeping the plant feasible and being used, we don't believe the cost of that move would be significant for the plant.
I think we're going to let Representative Schnald ask a few, and then Andy or...
I noticed in one of your slides it said that it did not include the trucking capital. Do we have any guesstimate on what that trucking capital might be? I suspect that it's will be a reasonable sum, and I'm just curious as to why that portion is not estimated in the cost of the whole project.
Through the chair, Mr. Speaker, the trucking we know is obviously, as this slide points out, is a part of the cost to get it to Fairbanks. I think the proposal, the financing that will be made available through ADA and the potential $50 million would not be used in the development of the trucking cost. We think that the trucking cost, in our understanding from discussing with the utility proponents that Ted has discussed, is that the trucking portion would be something that would be contracted with the trucking a trucking company to be able to provide this service. So the cost is definitely there. The financing package would not be something that would be utilized to help finance the trucking costs.
New question?
Okay, let me think about it. Also, Mr. Chairman, I've got a number of questions, and I certainly I understand the need for this project. I support the project. I have just a number of questions, as you can well guess, with the background that I've been dealing with for the last number of years, and you know, where we end up and how we do. I just have one simple question that's kind of off the side, but is ADA looking at financing any distribution build-outs for any other community in the state?
To the chair,
has it been approached?
Speaker Schnall, yes, we are looking at different distribution systems that would be under the CEPS program. We're looking at, right now, a small community outside of Anchorage has approached us on working on a air gas propane system and a distribution for that type of system. So we are starting to get requests based on distribution systems and facilities through our regular CEPS program.
Okay, and the reason I bring it up is because there's a community on the Kenai Peninsula, Homer, that the state funded a gas pipeline to their community, and they're actually going to pay part of that back through an assessed fee on their rates. But I also know that they've went and went as far as assessed their people. I think that their number is somewhere in the average cost per property parcel is in the neighborhood of $3,900 in order to get a gas distribution system to them. I see here that it's $300 to $500, and I'm not quibbling about it. I'm just curious as to what other communities, if any, have asked that question. So I will assume that the state of Alaska will see a number of communities that are going to expect to have distribution systems if if they're afforded the ability to get on some type of gas distribution system, that they will ask for funding for that. So I hope that the state is ready and willing to step forward and start paying for that for other communities. Mr. Chairman, I've got a number of other questions, and I can certainly ask them on the side about them. I would like to see us take care of Fairbanks. I'd like to see us try to move this project forward in this. I think as soon as questions are answered and asked and answered, then I think that we'll be able to.
This will be the only bill on the calendar for the Monday a week from now, and probably Wednesday. I think we'll probably block off of Monday and Wednesday. But with that, I'd like to give Representative Josephson a chance to ask a
sure,
quick question.
Sure, just be brief so we can get to the floor.
So while everything's fresh in everybody's mind, but
sure.
Will you guys be available Monday and Wednesday?
To the chair, yes, we would.
Just really two questions, and I don't want these to be suggestive that I pose this bill because it's frankly pretty inexpensive compared to some alternative. But question number one is, one slide you had indicated that it would serve 15,000 customers. There's 100,000 people in the North Star borough. And so how do we serve the other 85,000? Yeah, that's one concern.
To the chair, to Representative Josephson, I'll jump in, and Sarah, you can do it. Instead of people, mm-hmm. that this is actually estimating customers.
Okay.
So the customers for the full build-out would be about 19,000 customers. I believe that there's 22,000 to 25,000 total units.
Yes.
I see. Okay. So at two or three persons per unit, I see. All right. And then the second question is about the $105 million for distribution. Is that refers to trucking, not retrofitting homes? Is that right?
Through the chair, to Representative Josephson. The 105 distribution is to get the pipeline into the neighborhoods and to also do the mains to get it to the neighborhoods.
I see.
After the mains, then there would be a hookup from FNG or from IGU, and that's the estimate from going from the main to the house would be from $300 to $500.
I have nothing further.
Excellent. With that, we will adjourn at 10:25, and you guys will have at least the first 2 days of next week.
Appreciate it, Chair.